Tonight on Arena, Patrick Kavanagh's The Great Hunger performed in the grounds of the Irish Museum of Modern Art, and The Art of the Glimpse, Sinead Gleeson's new short story anthology. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The world looks on and talks of the peasant. The peasant has no worries in his little lyrical fields. He ploughs and sows. He eats fresh food. He loves fresh women. He is his own master, as it was in the beginning, the simpleness of peasant life. Mocking lines there from Patrick Kavanagh's long poem, The Great Hunger, the story of Patrick Maguire, a very unhappy peasant, farming the hungry hills of his Monaghan farm, consumed by lust and repression, and at the beck and call of his mother. The Great Hunger is the Abbey Theatre's production for this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. The poem is being dramatised in the grounds of the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Kilmainham in Dublin. Kay Sheehy went along to today's rehearsals in the rain, and she first caught up with actor Peter Coonan, sheltering under a tree.
How did you come to the part, and did you know The Great Hunger before this?
No, I didn't. I knew of the poem, but I didn't know the poem by hand, or I hadn't read it. I had been advised by my father at one point in my life to give it a read, but the time never arose. But gladly now I'm involved in this.
Patrick Maguire, how would you describe him?
Repressed man who is quite cynical about the Ireland that he's living in, the sterility of sexual repression and what comes with the responsibility of staying at home and minding the land and being tied to a degree to your matriarch of the family, or to a patriarch, depending on the scenario. His scenario is a matriarch, but yeah, I think it's a man who is frustrated by repression, and he cannot live the life that he should be living in, a middle-aged man. So I mean, it's a dark, satirical analysis of someone who is repressed. It's the beauty of the poem, the juxtaposition of this horrendous situation, but also the beauty of the land and the beauty of the surroundings and the words that are weaved together so beautifully by Kavanagh, and also the darkness of the times, and it's all put together in quite a remarkable piece of literature, and I hope we can do it justice.
So we've invited you to perform a piece, so could you put it into context?
Well, this is stanza 5, so we have been introduced to the world of Patrick Maguire and the people in the town, and at this point of the evening, if you want to put it from a day, from the start of the day on to the evening, it's the crossroads where there is a potential for excitement. Evening at the crossroads. Heavy heads nodding out words as wise as the ruminations of cows after milking. From the ragged road surface, a boy picks up a piece of gravel and stares at it, and then tosses it across the elm tree onto the railway. He means nothing. Not a damn thing.
The Great Hunger is directed jointly by Conall Morrison and Katrina McLaughlin. Conall, you and Katrina are the joint directors of The Great Hunger by Patrick Kavanagh. So it's the story of Patrick Maguire, a repressed farmer in Monaghan. What does it say to people today, the story of Patrick Maguire?
It has its own completeness in terms of Maguire's story and the story of kind of a rural community in the early decades of the 20th century, dealing with poverty, dealing with the difficulties of wresting a living from the land. So it has its own sort of magnificence as a poem and as a work of art. But it does connect into today, a community that's experienced its own loneliness and isolation and fear and loss. So without us hammering that too hard, the poem speaks to the current moment and the troubled atmosphere that we all live in.
Katrina, we're here in the courtyard of the Irish Museum of Modern Art. So we're here for the rehearsal, but the production is spread all over the grounds of Emma. Can you tell us what people will experience tonight and for the next few nights?
Yes, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, we're inside in the courtyard for the eventuality that there's lashing rain like there is just now. So if people come and the weather's like this, they're going to get a version inside the courtyard. But if anyone comes when the weather is a little bit less dodgy, the idea is that we travel through the whole grounds. So there are 14 different areas and a performer and musicians at each area. There's musicians that bring the audience through the 14 stanzas, through the journey of Maguire's life and around the whole circumference really of the whole of the site.
And then the imagery, obviously this beautiful courtyard and the outside, the grounds of Emma, but there's also music and visuals. Can you tell us a bit about that, Conal?
The poem is kind of rife with imagery, even though there's greater poverty in the man's life. It's just full of the most glorious kind of symbols and imagery and sensations. So being able to do it in the grounds of Emma allows us to unfold those images, to map the poem onto the place. Some of the kind of more rural corners of the grounds up at Emma, but also to connect them into some of the sculptures and some of the various little kind of hidden nooks and crannies. So the poem, as I say, for all its toughness, there's a glory, there's a magnificence to it, and being able to cite it in the Emma grounds, we're able to fuse the two together so that you get the complete package.
And Katrina, music is really important here. As I saw at the beginning of the rehearsal, Lisa O'Neill was here singing. What else can we expect in terms of music?
Well, we have 10 musicians here, a whole range of instruments really, from a double bass to guitars to drums to an accordion, a flute, saxophone. So there's a wide range of instruments. The idea is that the journey of the music isn't just one tone or one note or one style. So there, Conor Linehan has composed the music apart from a few little bits and pieces that the artists themselves have evolved. He's really chosen really strange instruments to pair with different stanzas. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but kind of unexpected and exciting really.
Conal, we know Patrick Kavanagh from The Green Fool and from Terry Flynn. How different is this?
This is notable because it's an epic poem. It's a sustained piece of work. It's over 14 stanzas. It has a lot of the Kavanagh hallmarks of, again, very, very startling images, a great connectedness to the land, a toughness, a bleakness, but also moments of enlightenment, moments of spirituality, where the nature just reveals itself in all its glories. So it's got a lot of the Kavanagh tropes, but it's a wonderful story. It is a poem, but it's a story, beginning, middle and end, the span of a life, the span of a community. So it's all in there. It's all in there. An epic poem, and hopefully an epic production to realise it.
Music there from Conor Linehan, finishing that report from Kay Sheehy. And The Great Hunger runs at the Irish Museum of Modern Art from October the 1st through until the 10th. Some changes to the schedules as part of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival, but you can find out full details on abbeytheatre.ie. 12 minutes past 7 on Wednesday night's Arena. Flannery O'Connor, the American short story writer, said, "A story is a way to say something that can't be said in any other way. And it takes every word in the story to say what the meaning is." It's a good week for Irish short fiction. We featured the RTE Short Story Competition final on Monday evening's programme. Tonight we explore a new anthology, The Art of the Glimpse, in the company of its editor, Sinead Gleeson, who's with me in studio. 100 stories, very round, very definite number there for sure, Sinead. Starts in terms of chronology, The Village Bully from Sheridan Le Fanu, published in 1851. Recent people included Sally Rooney, Blind by Boat Club, lots of other contemporary writers as well. Now, I was thinking of, this is your fourth anthology. Yeah. There was, you know, the first one was Silver Threads of Hope, but the ones that really struck me was, you know, The Long Gaze Back, an anthology of Irish women's writers, The Glass Shore, stories by women writers from North of Ireland. Very clear to see what you were anthologising there. The Art of the Glimpse, it's not as clear what you might be anthologising. Was there a guiding light or a guiding principle here, or was it just, I'll choose the ones I like?
Yeah, I mean, I think all anthologists, there's a lot of subjectivity. What I tried to do, this is part of a broader series. It's published by the UK publisher Head of Zeus, and they do these large books. So 100 is the number. Sophie Hannah did their crime one. Frank Wynne did an excellent one on translation. There's one on women. There's a ghost story one. So it had to be 100. And Neil Belton, who commissioned it, said to me, you know, I kind of want it to be sort of classic, great stories, stories to read before you die. So, because, you know, it took me 2 years to do. If I was commissioning brand new work from the start, it would have taken me 5. That's what happens when you get into commissioning. So they sort of had to exist, and I could look at single collections, I could look at archives, I could look at literary journals. So I literally, it was, you know, a supermarket trolley dash, so to speak. You could literally pick what you wanted. But then, you know, you start with a framework, you know, what you're going to include and who you're going to include and what kind of work and what kind of genres. And I wanted it to be as broad as it possibly could. There's been different points and angles to collections I've edited before. And if you're going to make an anthology, it can't look like the other ones. And I don't mean the ones by me. You have to make something new with it.
They're all Irish short stories.
100 Irish stories,
I bet you at some stage that if only I had 101. Or if only, and if you had 101, you'd want 102.
Oh, completely. And the thing is, you run into problems towards the end where you start, you know, you start to shake things up and see where the chips fall. And you think you might have too much of a certain kind of story, or you're looking at the gender balance, or you're looking at the kind of, you know, I want more ghost stories, I want more crime stories, whatever it is. But it did creep up to 100. I mean, it seems very daunting when you start off. But then, of course, I've been reading for years in the short story, and a lot of the research I do, you know, stuff that gets left over from previous anthologies, and I've been saying to people, you know, probably read about 15,000 or 16,000 stories cumulatively over the last few years to get to this point with this book. And you have to do that, because if you're going to do it, you have to do it properly. And also you have the fear that there's one elusive amazing gem that you haven't found. So you keep digging, you know.
And I guess it did. I bet you it galloped up to 100, and then you had to pull it back to 100 when you laid them all out on the table in front of you, or whatever way you went about that. But one that really jumped out was the Brendan Behan story, which is, this is a version of this short story that hasn't been seen that often. It's like very seldom seen in this country.
Absolutely. And one thing I always say about working in anthologies is that academics and people who do the kind of the day-to-day work of keeping writers' work alive have been central to this book. Amazing people, Pat Coughlin, Tina O'Toole, Geraldine Meany, all sorts of wonderful people. And this was a conversation I got into the opening night of the Molly Museum, actually. Somebody heard me talking about the fact that I loved Brendan Behan, a Crumlin writer, and I wanted to include him in the book, and told me a story about this story that's in the collection.
After the Wake.
It's been featured in various Irish collections over the years, but not this version. It was published in France in 1950 by Sindbad Vile, brilliant name, who's the grandson of Peggy Guggenheim, who ran a literary journal called Points, and then that was in 1950, and 55 produced an anthology where the story reappeared. It's a story that Behan deliberately published in France. He didn't want it published in Ireland. I doubt it would have got published in Ireland, because when you read the story, it's very clearly a queer and gay story. And the ending that's commonly reproduced, the story that you'll see most versions of, is the one where the ending is a little bit different. And he himself, the wonderful Deirdre McMahon in UCD, who's doing her PhD on Behan, said that she feels that he was trying to disguise something and maybe got the fear that somebody would find out about this story. And it's much more explicit, I think, because it's very erotic.
There's a couple, a married couple, and Behan live, well, I'm saying
they
Behan
live in a tenement,
and a narrator living downstairs,
and they're all very friendly, and they drink, the wife dies, and there's a beautiful word, I was talking about it today on Twitter, where they're drinking a lot and they get kind of, you know, maudlin drunk, and he calls it sob gargled, which is a wonderful word for it. But it's about, there's a very clear connection between the three of them, but very specifically between the male character and the husband, which, you know, I won't tell you the end of the story, but it's almost shocking, I think, to read it, because people maybe don't expect this kind of work, and people think of being primarily as a novelist and a dramatist and not a short story writer.
As I was reading the story, it struck me, until the word tenements comes in, and I don't know how far into the story that is, it could be anywhere, it could be any city, it could be any group of people.
And it doesn't feel old. It doesn't feel like from 1950.
Like the tenements kind of jumped up at me when I saw the word. That was kind of what set it in quite definitely, that period in Dublin. As I say, Behan, not necessarily the person we would think of in terms of the short story. May have been one of the first people we'd think of, I think, in terms of the short story and Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes what happens with anthologies, there can be a snobbery around what is classed as literary and what is a kind of a reductiveness about work that's more commercial. And to me, Binchy was brilliant and political and a highly comic writer. I've always loved the short stories. And I've loved this story for years. It's called Holland Park. Lots of her work was set in England, obviously. But it's about a female friendship. Well, it starts off about female friendship. And these two friends go to a dinner party with these people. You know, the people you meet on holidays you think you'll never see again. And they're so, you know, exotic and glamorous and lovely. But the story kind of pivots in that way that Maeve Binchy is really brilliant at doing that. But it's very funny and droll.
Yeah, it's very funny. It's great setup, this idea. Yeah. You know, well, let's all give each other our numbers. Then, you know, you get home and you say, I'm never going to call those people again. Because it's, you know, it's just the...
And they're trying to second guess the people. Like, she's going to make spaghetti. I bet she's not going to make it for real. Yeah. She won't make the sauce herself. And
it's very sarcastic. The narrator gets an invite to come to dinner. And brings her
friend, thinking the friend will laugh along with her. But they seem to embrace the friend. And the friend is now feeling, hold on a second, this wasn't the plan. I didn't want you to actually like them, you know. But it's extremely kind of comic story. And I think Binchy is so brilliant at dialogue, so brilliant at getting the way people talk and snark and give out about each other.
There was a little moment in it that in that Maeve Binchy story, I thought I had in my notes.
They go to the house and her friend has a kind of crappy car and all the other cars are really posh, and she said it's basically like the kind of the beat up thing in the playground where all the other things are really fancy. It's really well done.
And she just defines a whole set of people with that little moment of the cars.
It's very good on class and sort of social mores as Binchy often is in this stuff. And I think that there's a lot of stories in the book that deal with sort of class and intersection and where they sort of uncomfortably abut each other.
So let's talk then a little bit generally. We'll come back to the specifics of more of the stories in a moment. When you say the art of the glimpse, I'm remembering, I think it was Claire Keegan at some stage I heard speaking about the short story and about this idea of an arc, you know, and if you had a big bow, the short story is just from, you know, just at the point where the bow turns around. That's the bit that you're capturing.
That's it. Where
does that title, The Art of the Glimpse, come from?
It's funny. It actually comes from one writer in the book talking about another writer in the book. And the writer who said it is obviously a master of the short story and very well known to people, who's William Trevor, who's you know, I actually prefer his short stories to the novels. And he wrote an introduction to quite an obscure writer called Margaret Barrington. She was born in Mallon and Donegal. I featured her in The Glass Shore. And he was married to Liam O'Flaherty, who's also in the book. And he wrote the introduction to her only collection. She only wrote one collection of short stories, published 5 months after her death in 1982 with Wolfhound Press, I think. And he said that her gift for the short story was her gift for the art of the glimpse. And when I hear that phrase, I think of it as like looking through the chink of a door and only getting part of a scene. You don't get the start and the end. Maybe you might get the middle.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of these stories, that's what the possibility of the short story is. It can only, you know, it's 3,000 words, it's 10 or 12 pages. You're in somebody's head with a set of characters and a specific space for that short a period of time. So you have to make it count. And in the short story, I think every word does count. And that's why they're so hard to do and they're so hard to get right, I think.
Yeah, we were also talking on Monday's programme with Neil O'Connor and Tom Morris around this whole idea of, you know, that the short story, it's your friend is about to leave town.
Yeah.
But you have to stop them from leaving. And you're saying you've got 3,000 words to do it.
Yeah.
In some of these stories that you have in this anthology, they use 600 words or less.
Yeah,
even,
Mia
which
Gallagher's
is real
economy. Story and a wonderful story actually about abortion by Dermot Healy. I remember when I read it first, it's two pages, and it's like that great Kaiser Carver, the reunion, which is about a page and a half as well, about the father and son who get together. And again, that's the brevity of the short story. Mary Lavin is also included in this collection. She has one of my favourite descriptions ever of the short story. She called it an arrow in flight, and I think that's a brilliant description of how to place it and think about it, really.
Yeah, that is a lovely description of it, actually. And I mentioned Claire Keegan there. You have Antarctica is the Claire Keegan story that you have in there, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a story. It's funny. Joe Duffy mentioned the book on the radio last week, and he mentioned this story, and he said he's been tormented by the ending and what actually happens to the woman in it. And I can't tell you much about it other than it's like many of the stories in the book, it's dealing with relationships and in this case, infidelity. It's a married woman who's not necessarily unhappily married, but it's getting to the end of the year and she's starting to feel she'd like a change. So she goes away with the intention of sleeping with somebody who isn't her husband. And I can't tell you any more than that.
No, you can't.
No,
it's a short read, so you don't have to.
Yeah, but I think of that story. One of my all-time favourite short stories is The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, an incredibly chilling story published in The New Yorker in the 1940s that was the most complained about story to The New Yorker ever. People cancel their subscriptions. And I think it's one of the most chilling chilling. The hair on the back of your neck stands up when you read that story. And I feel like that about Antarctica. Not because of the chilly vibes, but because it's generally quite shocking and disturbing as a story.
A couple of voices that you were very keen to get in there. You wanted that all aspects of Irish society were presented. And I suppose particularly Mulatu Uche-Okorio, who has spoken to us in the programme about her collection of short stories, This Hostile Life. And also Eoin de Bhardún. Tell me a little bit about his story, which is almost like a folk tale.
Yeah, Eoin and Mulatu were both published by Skeen Press, a wonderful independent Irish publisher. And I'd heard about Eoin when I was talking to Skeen about Mulatu. He is a mint carer. He's a traveller. He works as an activist. He's head of Tome Tari, which is an Indigenous travellers language group. So he's very interested in language and happens to be a writer. And what Eoin does is that he takes and collects oral traveller folk stories and puts his own interpretation on them. And this is a story about grief and a funeral. It's called the yew tree or Tharsk, I should say, because he's very interested in cant and gammon and traveller languages. And it's a very evocative story. It's almost kind of supernatural as well, but it's very much of the land. It's very much of history. It's quite a lonely story. And again, it's one of those stories that's told in two pages.
And just briefly and finally, Blind Boy Boat Club. Obviously, we've had two collections, The Gospel According to Blind Boy and Boulevard Wren. What did you choose?
I chose Scapism, which is, again, it seems another relationship story about somebody who doesn't like his ex-wife's new partner, but it's what he decides he's going to do with this man. And Scapism, if you don't know what it is, we've got the Persians to thank for it, but it's a very grotesque and awful thing, and I won't tell you what it is. You might have to go and Google it.
Go and read that one
read
as well.
Story. Yeah, but it's, again, another kind of chilling end like the Clare Keegan story.
All right. Well, listen, congratulations on it. 100. I don't know how you whittled it down to 100. It's hard enough to whittle it down into whatever amount of time we've been talking to. There's a limit to everything, I guess. And you have to stick to that. Sinead Gleeson there speaking to me about The Art of the Glimpse, which is published by Head of Zeus. And you can hear more from Sinead at this year's Redline Book Festival. She'll be part of an online panel with two of the book's contributors, Blind Boy Boat Club, who we've just been speaking about, and indeed Mulatu Uche-Okorio. And that event takes place on Sunday, the 18th of October. You can find out full details on redlinebookfestival.ie. If It Were Love is a film that will be shown at the upcoming Gaze Festival at the Irish Film Institute. The film centres around the professional and personal lives of the dancers in a show called Crowd. This was a performance by choreographer Giselle Vienne, inspired by 90s rave culture. And in a time when we're still denied the fun of the dance floor, this film takes on perhaps a new meaning from what was originally intended. And joining me now to speak more about If It Were Love is the director of the film, Patrick Sheehan. Patrick, maybe you could start by telling me, I think this started out as a theatre piece, as a dance piece called Crowd, which you saw. Just describe what that piece was, first of all, if you could.
Yeah, of course. Hello. Crowd is an amazing piece, really a very strong piece. I know Giselle for a very long time. We are old friends. Giselle Vienne, the choreographer. And I think it's more than a dance piece. And I saw it at the premiere in Paris. I know all her work. And I was sitting in the first row. And it's about 15 dancers on stage and through a night. And about attraction and losing each other and coming together and coming apart. And I was sitting in the first row and I was amazed. Yeah, but it's not because something is beautiful that you have to make a film about it.
Yeah.
But there was so much space for all of us in a way. It's difficult to say, you know, if I could say it, I wouldn't have done the film.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. But I guess what interests me in some ways, and I'm picking this up from the film, because obviously I didn't get to see the stage piece itself. Mm-hmm. But what we get here is it's almost as if we're at rehearsals for a dance piece in some ways. Sometimes it feels like we're in the middle of a club, a nightclub. But at other times that we're in a space where there are dancers rehearsing with Giselle directing them and suggesting moves that they might make as, you know, to make the dance look better, I guess, or for it to be more effective. But then we also get asides from them, which you could do in film. We go backstage or we're talking to them elsewhere, where we get aspects of either the dancers' lives or characters that the dancers have invented. We get little snippets of their lives.
Yeah. You know, when you do a film like this, really, to film a dance piece, it's very mysterious. You have a feeling there's something you can discover. And then there's something very personal. Maybe I wanted to follow them through the fictional night. And Giselle opened the doors and we didn't know where we go. And of course, all you described, you see it in the film, but I never knew before what I will show, you know. So, of course, you have the piece. And then you have what we can call rehearsals, but they're not really rehearsals. They work all the time, you know, the whole day. And it's not to be better. I think it's to get deeper, you know. It's something, it's really the work of Giselle and maybe the work of art and about cinema is of getting, you know, letting go, you know, not the contrary of a decision. And how can we get free, you know, and we feel it when we go to a club or a big party at night. The beautiful moments are those moments where we don't control anymore ourselves. You know, when we get in a real feeling of present.
Yes.
And maybe the piece is, you know, it's about slow motions and all these things, is how do we get to the present?
Yeah, and in fact, many of Giselle's directions are precisely that. They're about, in some ways, the dancers getting themselves out of the way and letting the dance and the movement do the work rather than an intellectualization around it. But I wondered about those backstories that we get in the film. Yeah. Did they exist as part of the stage show as well, or was that something that you mined separately?
No, it's quite complicated, but very simple at the same time. Giselle, with the American author Dennis Cooper, wrote for every dancer kind of backstory. So when you see the piece, you don't get these stories, but the actors use these stories in themselves. But there's also a little humor in the film. So I played with these backstories, yeah? And with the dancers and the backstories. But there's humor because as a spectator, you never know what is inside the dancer, you know? When you film, you only film the skin, you know? You don't film more than the skin. So there's a dancer in the film making fun of these backstories. But at the same time, what is really beautiful for me is maybe not so much what the dancers are saying, but what are they doing with the backstories? And of course, we all know it's a cliche to say that actors use their real life on stage, but maybe it's the other way around. How do we use our fictions and fantasies in real life? You know, it goes both ways. Well, and so the backstory, so in the film, at one point, it's not clear, are they talking about their lives or the fiction on stage? But it's not a trick for me, you know, it's really something we all know in life. Sometimes it's not clear what we are talking about, you know. Is it what we live or what we want to live? Is it about our dreams or about our reality?
Yeah, and what I was wondering as a viewer then, sometimes you're thinking, is this the dancer or is this the dancer playing a character? But I guess that is the design. Let's have a listen to a clip that might show things a little bit clearer to the listeners for us. And this is a discussion about one of the dancers or one of the characters, depending on what way you want to put it, called Katya, who, another of the dancers who we hear speaking here, finds this character of Tatya, or this dancer Katya, absolutely terrifying.
She's terrifying in the show. It's like it's a magnet. It really pulls me, like whatever she does, like to watch her, to try and be close, but then you get close and it's like you feel that it's dangerous. Some days it's like it feels horrible and it's like an assault. And some days it's like, ah, yes, please, like, don't stop. Yeah, I don't know if she knows how much of a like a pull this is. It's like the black hole in the middle of the piece. Like, you know, if you go in, something huge is going to happen, but it just pulls you and pulls you and pulls you.
So there we go, a clip from the film If It Were Love, which we're speaking about tonight ahead of its screening at the Gaze Film Festival. And director Patrick Sheeha is speaking to me down the line this evening. That gives a perfect example of it, Patrick. You know, is that dancer, is he really frightened, or is the character pretending to be frightened? It really is that ambiguity. That's what you were looking for.
Yeah, no, you cannot look for ambiguity. I think it comes when you trust people. Well, they trusted me and I trusted them, and they understood really that I was not expecting something. You know, it's very difficult in film not to expect, but really I tried not to wait for something. So if you're waiting for nothing, there's ambiguity of life can come up. And here, of course, Theo talks about Katya, and he's called Theo, he's an English dancer. And it's beautiful, you know, I never listened like this here on the radio, but it's beautiful. But of course, he speaks about Katia on stage, and he speaks about the work around Giselle's piece. But in the way he talks, at the moment, you don't know how strong it is. You know, it's really mysterious. So I didn't decide, but I'm sure, and that's maybe the beauty of these moments, or for me, it's why they move me. It's because the dancers, they don't know either. Yeah. You know?
One final question, Patrick. When was this film made in relation to lockdown in your part of the world, for starters? And how did the whole COVID-19 situation and the fact that obviously we can't be on a dance floor at the moment and lots of dance performances that we've spoken on this programme have been adjusted and changed because of the restrictions in and around COVID. When you view the film now, has it taken on a whole new set of meanings, a whole different life?
Of course it changed, but I didn't notice it. You know, the film was released in France just before the lockdown and then re-released after. And during lockdown, I became like on Facebook messages from people, you know, talking about, it was the last film I saw. I miss touching and everything. I miss dancing. And it's a very hard time, I think, especially for dance and, of course, for clubs. And cinema for me, you know, it has something. The beauty of art is the question of touching, you know, even cinema, even if the actors are not here, you sit in the first row and you have the stars and you want to touch them and you want to be touched. So, the film, you know, I didn't think of things like this. Of course, when you do a film, you know, I don't expect anything. And then this happened and the film became such a, you know, this touching question, this being together and...
Yeah.
Touch each other became the central question. But maybe it's also the central question of Giselle's work in a way, you know. So, of course.
Well, listen, Spank, thanks for speaking with us this evening about the film. That's director Patrick Sheehad there. And If It Were Love is part of the Giz Film Festival at the Irish Film Institute. This year's the festival happens, like so many others, online. You can view If It Were Love from October the 1st onwards. And you can find out full details on ifihome.ie. Wynton Marsalis is one of the most respected musicians and composers in the world of jazz and classical music. He's also a cultural icon committed to issues of social, economic and political justice. His latest project, The Ever Funky Lowdown, is an opera, first performed in 2018 and just released in recent days as an epic 2-hour, 53-track album. Marsalis is only one of a handful of artists who has straddled the classical and jazz worlds with equal success in both and garnered equal respect from musicians in both camps as well. Here to talk with me about Marsalis' career in general and the Ever Funky Lowdown in particular is musician Michael Buckley. He is extraordinary in that respect, Michael, really, isn't he? That he has straddled both, if they are separate camps, but he has managed to straddle the jazz and the classical world in a way that very few do.
Yeah, he's the only one really that has done it with you know, his instrument. I mean,
he's a trumpeter. Yeah,
yeah, he's a trumpeter. Yeah. I mean, there is a case to be said. There is people, great jazz musicians out there who can cross over as well. Mm. But he was the kind of first one to do it, and he does it with such confidence and such ease. When he was young, he was about 19 years old, and he left to live in New York to study.
His father, though, was a jazz musician. His father was involved in,
He just passed away in the last few months, Ellis Marsalis. And Wynton talks a lot about growing up with his father.
Where did he grow up?
Sometimes he spent times in New Orleans, and then he moved, as I said, moved very young to New York. The whole family are great musicians.
Yeah.
You know, all the brothers play. Bramford, obviously, is the older brother, I think a year or two older, who's, like me, saxophonist. So I was very influenced by him also. And his brother, also the trombone player, and Jason, the drummer. So
and Jason, the drummer, is involved in the Ever Funky Lowdown.
He does a lot of stuff with Wynton over the years. Yeah,
so he's very heavily involved in some of the tracks.
Yeah.
You know, there are some of them that are totally percussion-driven, actually,
in
some ways. But just sticking with this idea of the crossover situation, the saxophone is one of the instruments that, you know, we possibly associate it more with jazz music than we do classical music.
Yeah.
But in the case of the trumpet, a much older instrument, an instrument that did have a classical background before it got its jazz background. The saxophone kind of maybe grew out of the jazz world, really, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, the trumpet is a very demanding. It's much more than the saxophone. Some people won't like saying that, but
your saxophone colleagues will be at you for that one.
But technically, your chops-wise, your embouchure and how you physically blow the instrument is much tougher, because it's like the saxophone, you could leave for 2 or 3 weeks, come back to it, and you won't know a difference. You know, slightly. But the trumpet is one of them instruments you have to be really regimented and every day working on your embouchure and working on your chops.
By the embouchure you're talking about there is that the way your mouth is shaped around the mouthpiece, and the trumpeter will talk about his or her lip.
Yeah.
You know, and the lip and being out of shape or the lip being in shape.
And
literally.
They love to talk about that, believe me. With the trumpet also, it is a thing where Winton is definitely one of those very gifted and, you know, he was destined to play the trumpet. Like he was, there's only a handful of great musicians like that on the trumpet. Who are really...
And which was it first? Where did he excel first? Was it in the jazz area, or was it... Because he went to the Art Blakey Quartet. Was he 14 or 15?
No,
very young.
He was a bit older. He was 19, 18, 19.
I thought he was a little bit younger.
So
than that,
he went to study in Juilliard. So he went to study as... When he went to New York, he was about 18, 19. And he went to study in Juilliard as a classical player.
Mm.
And got the gig with Art Blakey. I was asked to tour Europe, and he did that for quite a while, and then decided to stick with being a jazz musician after that.
Yeah.
But still did his classical studies, but went on to be a jazz musician, of course. But the thing you have to remember at that age, like to be one of Blakey's jazz messengers at that age, you're already set up as a legendary jazz musician. Like anybody that played in that band. All are very well known.
What kind of names would jump out? You know, the household names that would come from that Art Blakey stable.
Wayne Shorter, great saxophone players. There was so many great trumpet players. Freddie Hubbard, all them. So there was a huge influence for him on the back of that also. But
so his debut jazz album then, which was Sister Cheryl. Did he win the Grammy straight out type
of thing? No, Sister Cheryl was a track from that album. The album was just called Winter Marcellus.
Oh, sorry, yes, self-titled album.
But I'm not sure if he won a Grammy for that straight. I know he's into about 9 Grammys at this stage. Mm. And I know he's the only person to ever win a Grammy in the same year for a jazz album and a classical album.
Yeah.
So I remember this album. I was a bit later now coming to it because I think it came out in 82 or 83. I would say it was about maybe the 90s, you know, 89 when I had it. I was about 19 then or 18. And it's a great writing, great. And the band, of course, on that is like Herbie Hancock. You know, it was all his peers at the time. You know, it was an amazing, I think Herbie Hancock produced it too. So they all wanted a bit of Winton at that stage as well, because they knew, you have to remember, I remember around that time, in the early 90s, I remember one week alone on you know, watching TV where one day he was on for being on the front of Time magazine. And then about 2 days later, there was a 60 Minutes Dan Rather's interview with him. So he was everywhere at that time.
Let's have a listen to it. We've talked enough about how he got there, but let's have a listen to a little bit of Sister Cheryl then, as you say, from that self-titled debut album. 1982, in fact, was the year. Okay, so there's Winton Marsalis from his debut self-titled album with a jazz style. Now, almost on the back of that, he produces this classical album, a little bit of Haydn's Trumpet Concerto in E-flat here. ¶¶ And I just wanted to get a little flash of that in to hear the difference there, Michael, the different styles that we're getting from Wynton Marsalis. I mean, it is extraordinary, Michael Buckley, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, talking about styles as well, like when he grew up with his father at a young age, he was listening to so many different and influenced by so many different musicians, friend of his father's. He talks about that a lot, about them all, you know, over the house playing music. So he had this huge body by the time he was 20, 21 of influences. So, you know, he could on a dime change to one style to another. So, he could play very famously later on with the Lincoln Jazz Center, went kind of back in time, did all the Satchmo stuff, did all the Duke Ellington stuff. And he was really started to be a historian about with music. And that's why the styles, and he can really...
And that is what we get in the Ever Funky Lowdown. It really is a 53-track jazz album, I think I said. But really, it's such a mishmash is not fair. It's such a broad range of styles of music that are covered here.
It is, and
styles of playing.
It is. Well, he says himself with this album, he didn't do a lot of research for it. And which is interesting, because he said...
Had it all done.
He said most albums, most projects, he'll do an awful lot of looking into it and he'll delve very deeply into it. But he said this one he didn't, because it's all part of his growing up. All the Afro-American music, all the, the church music that's in it. There's hints of classical music in it as well. He talks about all them influences, and he brings all to this album.
Yeah, and there's a track or a motif, I suppose, called the Ever Funky Lowdown that appears about six or seven times, I think, throughout
in
different ways and in different styles. Well, here's the Ever Funky Lowdown in 4, and I think you get a sense of the church music here, you get a sense of the soul music here, you get a sense of the funky side of things as well. Absolutely super stuff in terms of just, the clashes of styles that we're hearing there. The Ever Funky Lowdown in 4, and that's from an opera, first performed in 2018, composition by Wynton Marsalis, and now being released as a 2-hour, 53-track album. And musician Michael Buckley speaking to me about it, and indeed Wynton Marsalis this evening here in Arena. That gives us a sense of the musical side of things. But what's really important here, I mentioned that he has always been committed on issues of social, economic and political justice. That's at the heart of what the story he's telling, or maybe the polemic he's giving us in this opera, Michael.
Yes. He talks a lot. There's so much to this album. There really is. It's incredible. It's not a one that you would have in the car. It's definitely a sit down and... really analyze it. It's incredible. But he basically, what is it? He's looking at corporate society, corporate world, too, greed, and he has a character that narrates through this,
Mr. Game,
and basically he's like a soothsayer, or he's a hustler. So that's the way they look at it. So, even the name, the Funky Lowdown, and it's not it's
Fonky.
Yeah, so. It means there's something rotten. There's two meanings. There's something rotten to it. That's what he's trying to get across, what Wynton talks about it. And there's also funky, as in 70s music too.
Yeah.
And the lowdown is the greed, corruption, but also I'll give you the lowdown.
I'm exposing this.
And
Wendell Pierce is the narrator, is the Mr. Game character throughout the thing, who basically leads us through it. He is like a narrator. He's like a Brechtian narrator in some ways, in that he steps out and says, here's what this is about. And then he kind of goes back into the piece and becomes part of it again.
Yeah. And it's, basically, if you look at it, I know we don't have too much time to talk about it, but Wynton talks to, it's like, we've got two sides. And that's basically what it boils down to. So he's got, say we take the Democrat and we've got the Republican. He talks about, Winton talks about this himself. He says, you know, you're creating a problem with each, you know, with each side. There has to be that problem to you know, divide.
He's not necessarily coming down hard on one side or the other. He's just, he's saying that we need this division in, or this division is there in society. Let's have a listen to one of the narration parts, which I think explains that quite well. This is a section called Talk is a Waste of Time. Wendell Pierce, the narrator here, or Wendell Pierce as Mr. Game.
I'm a preacher and a teacher, a soul reacher and a defense breacher, as I fear there are about to be more of them than us. They're like rabbits. Are we going to let them sit there breeding away our freedom? We are winners. We can't have them competing with us, because competition is an act of aggression. Some have suggested talking to them, but talk is a waste of time, and we don't have time. Every second wasted is a second given to them. Believe me, oh, glorious people, I think I heard that they've been committing nefarious crimes, and they don't believe in God. We must hold them accountable. Let me take care of this. Please, folks, don't take our freedoms for granted. Thank you for your trust, and you're doing quite well.
Wendell Pierce there. I suppose people will remember Wendell Pierce as Detective Bunk, in particular, Bunk Moreland, rather, in the TV show The Wire. That's what they'll know him that for. And you were saying, as we were listening to that, Michael Buckley, that Wynton Marsalis is very clear that this is a white man talking to white people.
To white people, yeah. And even when he mentions, when he talks about slavery in it, and he's not saying who that is. He's not saying, you know, but he is a white man talking to white people.
Yeah, yeah, there's quite definitely, there's a section where they give us a kind of a history of slavery, and it's almost portrayed as, well, these people needed this to be done for them. Slavery was a way to freedom, whatever way you can that up in your head.
He's not saying who it is at any point.
Is there? What do you think about the timing of the release of this? Obviously, the opera was first performed in 2018, so that's kind of the midterms, if you like, after the election of Donald Trump in 2016. But here we are in the teeth of an election campaign, first debate last night. I presume that's not accidental. How political an animal are we talking about in the case of Marsalis?
I think he's getting more, as I've watched him even over the last week, and, you know, he seems to be getting more politically driven. There's a very good, was chatting to Bill Maher, and you can definitely see he's getting more driven, politically driven at the moment.
And while he's saying there's a them and us scenario, are his politics easy to guess?
It's more liberal. He's trying to get across the notion in this that we have to, like his music, it's a conversation. And he's basically saying, there's got to be a conversation. People got to open their eyes, look around, and there's got to be a conversation on both sides. But look at last night. Yeah. There's not going to be much conversation.
There wasn't a lot of talking to each other, lots of talking at each other and over each other. Let's have a listen to another track from the opera, for the album then, the ever funky lowdown that we're speaking about. This is called Night Trader, and I think we get his ideas on capitalism are pretty clear in this track.
Put them in jail till they commit the crime. I'll put them away for a long, long time. I'm a night trader, baby. I'm a night trader. Sleight of hand by trade.
I'm a night trader. I'm a night trader. I'm a night trader. I'm a night trader. I'm a night trader.
There, a little section from Night Trader from the opera and album that we're speaking about this evening, the ever funky lowdown, the composition from Wynton Marsalis, and saxophonist Michael Buckley speaking to me about it this evening. Is this kind of Wynton Marsalis at the top end of what he can do in terms of bringing all his musical experience and styles together, do you think, Michael?
I think, like, these are definitely, he's definitely very clear, these are musically styles from his youth and growing up. Some would argue, you know, some would argue with Wynton that he never took things forward enough. He stopped around the 70s with music, as in, once he got into Ornette Coleman, beyond, when avant-garde music kicked in, he
Yeah, there is that sense that he's looking back to funky, that he's looking to funk music, that he's looking back
Ellington,
to soul.
Ellington, swing, like
first half of the 20th century, even in his classical taste, but obviously Haydn isn't. But
he came out very strongly about rap music. So
against it.
Yeah, against it. More the message. It wasn't to do with the music. It was the message. As he said, in the 70s, he was playing, growing up, he was playing like Earth, he was playing in bands that were not Earth, you know, played Earth, Wind and Fire music. And he said 5 years, 6 years after that, rap music was very prominent. And the message was, he just didn't believe in the message. You know,
all right.
Killing cops and, you know.
Bigger discussion that one, but certainly Michael Buckley there is talking to us about the legend that is Wynton Marsalis and that new album, The Ever Funky Lowdown, jazz operatic comment upon our relationship with global power elites. That's what we're told it is. It is out now. And that is our lot here on Arena this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.